Welcome, everyone, to the new Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdern. With me is my co-host, Barry Rose. Barry, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm sitting here with a mug of some eggnog, and I'm enjoying the holiday season.
I don't know why. You should have been drinking the eggnog on our previous episode discussing the holiday movies, but I'm going to let it slide this time. On the show, we're not going to just break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We're going to break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on life. And on today's episode, it's a special edition of Breaking Kayfabe. Yes, the special edition is back. Tonight, we're going to do a top 10 list that has nothing to do with wrestling. Folks, it is our top 10 guy movies of all time. Now, let me explain. A guy movie is a movie that strictly appeals to the male gender. If you try to sit and watch it with a woman, she's going to go, what am I doing sitting here with you watching this movie? We're each going to come up with our top 10. I will also say not all these movies are what you would classify as good movies. Some of them are complete train wrecks. They're pieces of trash, but there are glorious pieces of trash. So, Barry, you about ready to go, my man?
I am ready to rock and roll.
All righty. That's a pretty good intro there, Mr. Promo Guy. So, Barry, why don't you give us your and let's, folks, we're going to try it. This is 10. We handled the top five last week. 10, maybe a little heady for us. Barry, what's your number 10? Guy movie of all time.
And for anybody betting right now, what are the odds that Jeff and I are going to be able to keep this straight to make the top 10 movies? It would be 20 movies total. It's not going to happen. But
Barry, so what's the you're at number four now, aren't you? Up already.
Exactly. Exactly. So what's the criteria for a guy movie? And I know that we were having this conversation with our executive producer, Brian, last off air. But what is the criteria for a guy movie, Jeff?
Well, as I said, it's a movie. There's usually a lot of testosterone in the movie. Okay. It's a movie that either has got action, blood and guts, or it's humor, but of lowbrow humor where women are, you're going to be laughing your ass off, but the woman's going to be rolling her eyes going, that's just so inappropriate. So that's basically the criteria. It's a movie that's pretty much geared towards the male population.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. So for me, number 10, and I have a hard time with all of our lists, because when you try to really pigeonhole something as a top 5 or a top 10, I think I had 20 movies here, and I had to whittle it down, and it really came down to the movie, which was my number 10 choice, versus Highlander, and I love Highlander, but I went with number 10, which is Raiders of the Lost Ark. And what you just said about about being a guy movie and what the criteria is and all that, this movie has that tenfold. This is a movie that when I first saw Raiders of the Lost Ark in, I believe it was 1981 when the movie was released, I remember walking out of the movie theater thinking I had just seen the greatest movie of all time, the greatest movie ever filmed. And it was a literal roller coaster from the beginning, when he's going for, what he's going for, and that the big ball is chasing him, till the very end. Just an amazing movie. Harrison Ford, who already, I was a huge fan of his work prior to Raiders, just seeing this movie just kind of blew me away. What are your thoughts?
Oh, it's a great movie. I would say in my, not just guy movie, in my top 20 to 25 movies of all time, I'd say Raiders of the Lost Ark is right up there. I mean, just everything you could want from an action movie is in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, and so here's something interesting, too. So on last week's episode, you brought up, we were talking about Christmas movies, and you brought up the movie Scrooged, which featured Bill Murray and the great Karen Allen, who I had a massive crush on Karen Allen. She's also in this movie, and she's also in Animal House, which I think was her first movie, and or at least her biggest first movie. So why didn't she become a bigger star? She's a competent actress, very attractive. She was in a movie with Jeff Bridges in 1984 called Starman. And you and I both have talked about Jeff Bridges. I'm a huge Jeff Bridges fan. But Karen Allen, as an actress, very solid, very attractive. Why didn't she become a household name?
I really don't know, other than to say that Hollywood has a way of taking young, attractive women and sort of spitting them up and using them and getting rid of them. And you wonder whether or not, some women can take the transition from starring roles into doing more minor supporting roles. Some can't. Maybe that happened to Karen Allen. I really don't know. But you're right. In every one of those movies, she was very solid.
And these are, so if you look at it too, Animal House and Raiders, really one of the two biggest movies of that kind of generation right there, which would be late 70s into early 80s. Scrooged, I think, was, you know, later in the 80s. Starman was 84. So she did continue to work, but she held her own, and I thought she was just great in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, no, and, you know, Harrison Ford battling the Nazis. I mean, right there. How can you go wrong?
Yeah, you really can't, too. And it's, you know, there's so many great actors, and there's these small actors. It's, you know, the guy who plays Belloc, just a great kind of villain in his kind of smooth, charming disposition. But yeah, Harrison Ford battling the Nazis. And this falls into what we also talked about on last week's episode. I don't like sequels. And, you know, even with the Raiders sequels, I saw the second one, which I think was Temple of Doom, if I'm correct. Temple of Dumb.
Yes.
And didn't like it. And I really didn't like any of the sequels that followed that either.
I like the one with Connery, which I believe was The Lost Crusade. That was a good one. The ones with Shia LaBeouf, I got no use for those. But the first one is definitely the top of the heap. The second one, not so good. Third one was very, very good. Solid to very good, but not to the level of the very first one.
Yeah, I'd agree with you on that. So Jeff, in keeping count, that was my number 10. What is your number 10 favorite guy movie?
My number 10, I'm going to go all the way back to 1968. And to me, this was the movie that introduced the car chase to the American film goer, Steve McQueen, the King of Cool in Bullet. And Bullet, he plays a San Francisco cop. Here's what's interesting. Apparently, the character of Bullet was actually based on a real-life detective, and it's the same guy that was played by Robert Downey Jr. in the movie Zodiac. I did not know that. But Bullet is this no-nonsense cop who kind of, you know, works on the edges of the law, proverbially, and he has lost his key witness and is trying he was killed, and Bullet is trying to hide the fact that his witness has been killed. And the mob who has killed him is coming after Bullet because they think he has stolen the witness away that is getting ready to go to trial. We got Jacqueline Bisset, Robert Vaughn, Robert Duvall, Simon Oakland. There's a guy we never talked about. What a great character actor Simon Oakland is.
Amazing.
And this movie has one of the, you know, I have to tell you folks, down there's a spoiler alert. Down the road, Barry and I are going to do a top 10 movie car chases of all time. The car chase in the movie Bullet, we're talking now almost 50 years later, and the images of that Ford Mustang and the Dodge Charger going through the streets of San Francisco until the ultimate climax is just an amazing, amazing chase. And when you hear the Charger pull off, you know, McQueen and the Mustang is following the Dodge Charger. They're at a stop sign. All of a sudden, the Charger hits the gas and takes off. Bullet puts the shift in gear. He knows it's on now. The tires begin to spin, and you go on about a 15, 20-minute car chase through the streets of San Francisco, up over the hills, and out into the outskirts of town, and it's just crazy, and it still holds up 50 years later. Barry, what do you think of this movie?
Yeah, it definitely holds up 50. And didn't Steve McQueen have a hand in choreographing the car chase scene?
I was actually reading up a little bit about this today. He was... When they were doing, you know, of course, naturally, this wasn't filmed in one take, but in one of the early takes, Steve McQueen was actually doing the driving of the Mustang. And during one of the sequences, he sort of the side of his car crashed into a parked car, and he was not hurt, but it freaked out his wife at the time so much that she went to the director and said, yeah, you need to have a stuntman in there doing the scene when you start shooting the next sequence. And so McQueen shows up to the movie set ready to shoot the next scene in the sequence and sees a stuntman in his car and was totally pissed off at the director for basically, you know, using a stuntman where he wanted to be the one behind the wheel. But there were tons of scenes within that sequence where you see McQueen behind the wheel and, you know, they're going speeds, you know, 80, 90 miles an hour through the streets of San Francisco. And it's just tremendous stuff.
Was that wife Ollie McGraw, by the way?
No, this was before he met Ollie McGraw. Because
gotcha.
He did, I don't think he met Ollie McGraw until like the early 70s when they filmed the movie called The Getaway.
The Getaway, which is another fantastic movie, which, yeah, absolutely could have made our list. Didn't make mine, but certainly could have. So this is a great movie, too, and this is a movie that the fact that it was made in 1968, it, you know, so long ago, we're 49 years removed from the making of this movie, almost 50 years removed, is kind of unbelievable on a lot of different levels, too. Steve McQueen is one of those guys that died at a young age. I'm going to guess he was late 40s, maybe 50 years old, had a pretty solid body of work, but kind of went out on top. Like, you know, when he died, he still had many years in front of him where he could have been making movies. I just watched The Towering Inferno the other night. It was on cable, and I watched it, and he's great. Steve McQueen is one of those guys that had the it factor. He could be on something, could be on screen, and he's going to own that screen. And you mentioned the name Simon Oakland. So, Simon, you and I talk about this all the time, but Simon Oakland, as a character actor, as a guy in a supporting role, he was in everything in the 70s. He's on Barnaby Jones, you know, Cannon, whatever those shows were that were, you know, on. But he also was in a great episode of The Twilight Zone. And since we've been a little Twilight Zone intensive in the past couple of months, he was in an episode called The Rip Van Winkle Caper. And I just watched it about a week or so ago. And I was texting with our buddy Harold Strassler. And I kept saying, you know, I'm watching this episode right now. And he goes, oh, that's a great episode. And Simon Oakland just steals that episode. Bullitt, fantastic. And I'm really excited. You mentioned this, but I'm really excited about the car chase episode that we have coming up at some point. Because when you said that to me immediately, I got right on the computer and I started drawing up a list. So I'm actually looking forward to that.
So, well, that's the only spoiler we're going to offer today, folks. So, okay. Number nine, guy movie of all time. Barry, what you got?
Yeah, I've got it. Dead or Alive, You're Coming With Me. It's 1987's RoboCop. So if you've never seen this movie, you know, you've lived underneath a rock or in a cave for the last 30 years. Detroit cop Alex Murphy, loving husband, good cop, gets critically injured in the line of duty, and this big business called Omnicorp sees their chance, and they create a part man, part robot police officer. And I remember seeing this movie when it came out in 87 and just blowing my fucking mind. I walked out and I'm walking around going, Dead or Alive, You're Coming With Me. Just absolutely love it. And as I've mentioned on many of our previous episodes, I go to every monster con I can possibly go to. And Peter Weller was at the last one I went to. So I was super stoked. I'm like, Peter Weller, RoboCop at my monster con? Super excited. Showed up. I bought a RoboCop lithograph poster. I want to say I paid $50 or $60. It's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. Only 100 copies of it. And then I brought it over to Mr. Weller, and I got him to autograph it. So it was kind of cool, because when I put it down in front of him, he says, where did you get this work of art? And I introduced him to the artist then. I went back and I told the artist, and he came over and he gave him a copy of it. So he said, you know, how would you like me to inscribe this? And I said, you know, obviously you can make it out to me and sign your name. And he goes, I'd be more than happy to put a RoboCop quote in there. So he puts in Dead or Alive, You're Coming With Me. And then he looks at me, and he was a very engaging guy, which is what I thought was cool. This wasn't like a 30-second, which is what I always say about CWF Legends Fan Fest. It wasn't a 30-second meet and greet. He full-out engaged us in conversation. So he said, what do you think my favorite line of the entire movie is? So I'm sitting there and I'm racking my brain and I'm saying, you know, a bunch of different, you know, Murphy, it's you, and all these other lines. And he goes, do you remember the older guy in the movie? And he goes, he looks at Dick, and Dick was the actor who was in Beverly Hills Cop, Ronnie Cox. He's another great character actor. And he goes, Dick, I'm very disappointed. And I sat there, and being such a fan of this movie and hearing Peter Weller just say this line with all this enthusiasm, I literally was just popping out of my shoes. So RoboCop for me, huge movie. I actually do like the sequel. I didn't like 3 because he wasn't in it. But RoboCop 1 for me, top 9 guy movie of all time.
Yeah, and I believe his female co-star was Nancy Allen, who was a a very, I believe she was married to Brian De Palma, wasn't she?
She was. So, and that's a great story. And we certainly, you know, I if anything, I hijack almost every episode at this point.
How dare you?
How dare me? Nancy Allen was married to Brian De Palma. And Nancy Allen in 1983 was making a very low budget kind of shitty movie called The Philadelphia Experiment with the great Michael Paré from Eddie and the Cruisers. Do you remember this movie?
I do, actually.
So they wound up having an affair, and she wound up leaving De Palma because of Michael Paré. And they went on a press junket when the movie was released, and they did the press junket as a couple. The movie tanked, and then their relationship tanked, and it was over like right after that.
I remember Nancy Allen was in a movie called Blowout with John Travolta. I'm not sure if that's where she met De Palma, but I know that was a De Palma film.
Yeah, De Palma, and that's, boy, there's a great, for a future episode, too, De Palma films, and I certainly have a favorite, which I will not reveal just in case we ever do it, but I always, so Nancy Allen falls into that Karen Allen thing for me. I always felt that Nancy Allen should have been a bigger star as well. A solid actress and very attractive as well.
Yeah. So, okay, time for my number nine. As I said at the beginning of the show, folks, not all of these movies are great movies. RoboCop's a great movie. Raiders of the Lost Ark, a great movie. What's not a great movie is a movie called Stone Cold. Stone Cold stars Brian Bosworth, the former Oklahoma All-American linebacker, who was a pretty well-known athlete in the mid to late 80s in college football and sort of a national figure. And in 1991, he made this movie called Stone Cold, where he plays... I'll just read you the IMDb description because it's funny. A tough Alabama cop is blackmailed by the FBI into going undercover in a violent Mississippi biker gang. So Bosworth still had the mullet from his days at Oklahoma, the bleach blonde mullet. He's totally jacked to the gills. And the movie also stars, we always mention the co-stars, Lance Hendrickson and William Forsythe. William Forsythe is another guy that just is in so many great movies as a, you know, we mentioned in a previous episode, Buzz Sawyer, how he plays this maniacal guy. And I often wonder if William Forsythe was like that in real life because he does such a great job in the movies of playing complete maniacs that you wonder if it's a shoot. So in this movie, you have this violent Mississippi biker gang led by Lance Hendrickson, who during the course of the movie has one of the all-time great movie lines where he says his character's name Chains, because, you know, every biker gang is led by a guy named Chains. He says, you know, it's moments like this that I think of my father's last words, which were, "Don't, son, that gun is loaded." High quality, highbrow stuff like that. So the cap of the movie, and one of the things that I love so much about it, is the biker gang on their choppers, on their Harleys, storms the Mississippi Supreme Court. They drive their motorcycles into the courtroom where the Supreme Court is hearing arguments on a case. It's so completely over the top. Bosworth is absolutely, he's hilarious in the role. You know, not meaning to be, because it's a bad performance. He makes these direct-to-video movies now, but he was just so over-the-top hilarious in this movie. It's every time it's on, I watch it because it's a movie that you watch. It's great action, but you're laughing at the characters because the performances are so over-the-top. Barry, have you ever managed to catch this movie?
I have. So this is one of those that when it airs at midnight and it's on cable, you got to put it on because it's B-movie at its best. It's super cheesy. The star of the film is the mullet that is resides on Bosworth's head. It's good. I don't remember a ton about the movie. It's, you know, this, I do know this movie was supposed to catapult him into superstardom. And as you just mentioned, that did not happen. And now he does straight to DVD or late night cable. But yeah, it's a fun movie. I've seen it a couple of times.
Let's remember the tagline: God forgives, the Brotherhood don't. That's Lance Hendrickson just had quotes flowing left and right. This is one, if the proverbial Saturday afternoon, I got nothing to do. Let me check out Netflix and see what Baudrin recommended. Oh, there it is. You know, the stupid Brian Bosworth movie. Let me check that out. That's why you watch Stone Cold, folks. Okay, Barry, number eight.
Number eight is The Longest Yard. And we're talking the original from the early 70s with Burt Reynolds. Prison inmates basically, Burt Reynolds gets sent to jail, and the prison inmates basically form a football team, and they're challenging the prison guards. And this is one of those movies that I remember watching as a kid, so I was probably, 10 or 11 years old, and in watching this movie, just thinking to myself, oh my God, this is great. Burt Reynolds is so cool. He's the epitome of cool. I think this is his best movie. Pardon me. And I was a big Burt fan, even with the shitty movies he was making, I was still a fan. And I love Sharky's Machine. I always felt that was a decent movie, but The Longest Yard is great. And Burt, he had this kind of cool swagger thing going in this movie. He's very confident, but very sarcastic. And, there's so many, we talk about one-liners and things like that. And, there's a scene here where the cops, goes to up to Burt and says, "Why'd you drive her car into the bay?" And Burt says, "Well, I couldn't find a car wash." And, at the end of the movie, the walking boss, who was a real dick, and most of these prison guards were portrayed as real assholes, and he looks at Burt, and Burt's just won the game, and he goes, "Fuck you, boy," and Burt looks at him and smiles and goes, "Not today, boss." Just thought it was great. And there was such a great cast of characters, too, and I think with a movie, and you and I have touched on this in previous episodes as well, but when you've got a movie, movies are character-driven, and this one has got, it's got the guy who played Jaws, Richard Kiel. But it's got a character, and the character's name is Connie Schachner. Do you remember him?
Played by the great Robert Tessier.
Boy, you do remember. He was. So here was a guy, and I remember watching him as a kid, having no idea who he was, but hearing the name Connie Schachner, and it was the way that they set it up, and you've got this character named Caretaker, in the movie, and he goes, "Well, there he is, Connie Schachner. He's the baddest cat in the joint. Even the guards are scared of him, and he killed 3 people on the outside and 2 since he's been in here." And Burt Reynolds goes, "Yeah, that karate's some bad stuff." And Caretaker responds, "Oh, that was before he learned karate." And Burt Reynolds says, "Well, say, what's he doing now? Nobody's ever had the guts to ask him." So I love this movie, character-driven, some great lines. It's got a great ending, and please do not get this confused with that 2005 remake with Adam Sandler.
Yeah, because nothing screams athlete like Adam Sandler, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Besides, I actually was, first introduced to Robert Tessier in a Charles Bronson movie. I can't believe we don't have a Charles Bronson film on my list. A movie called Hard Times with James Coburn, Charles Bronson. It had Strother Martin. That's not on my list. It probably should be. That's a great, it's about bare knuckle fighting. And in the movie, Robert Tessier fights Charles Bronson in the movie. He's a really good bald headed character actor. Very visually is very recognizable. Besides the guys you mentioned, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking of the different guys. Joe Capp, the former Vikings quarterback. Who else? Believe Ben Davidson. There's a lot of old football players that made it. Ray Nitschke. Ray Nitschke plays one of the guards who has a slight mishap during the course of the game in The Longest Yard. But this is a tremendously fun. Eddie Albert plays the prison warden. The head of the guards is played by a guy named Ed Lauder. Ed Lauder is another guy that's in about 100 movies during the 70s and early 80s. Yeah.
Ed Lauder he's one of the great character actors, and he's always this bad guy. He's always playing this kind of he's either in the military or he's a cop in every single movie.
It's funny because I was just telling Barry, I had a chance the other night to watch a movie called The Last American Hero with Jeff Bridges. And Ed Lauder's in that movie. It's so funny you bring that up. He plays sort of this heel stock car owner in The Last American Hero, which is another great movie. We could spend the whole night talking about great movies. Okay, so now I'm already losing count. What number am I up to, Barry? Am I at 8? Sorry, Brian.
Putting this on my hands. All right. Yeah, I believe it's 8.
My number 8 movie is one of those movies that if you're a guy and you have never seen this movie, first of all, I'm taking away your man card, because my number 8 movie is about two brothers who are on a mission from God. Jake and Elwood, blues playing musicians. Jake got out of the joint in Joliet, where they serve a wicked pepper steak. And it's the adventures of these two brothers who are trying to raise money for their church that they used to belong to. And boy, you talk about a movie that has one-liners left, right, and center, and a soundtrack that's just out of this world. So many funny lines. You get my cheese whiz, boy. You know, I can't even think about how many great lines there are in this movie because we're the good old boys. And we play both kind, country and Western. Barry, please tell me you've seen this movie not once, but about 50 times.
We're on a mission from God. So, yeah, I've seen this movie 100,000 times. Maybe that's a slight exaggeration, but I absolutely love this movie. There's the scene. So this movie has everything. This movie's got some violence. This movie's got some profanity. I don't think there's a lot of nudity. But musically, this movie is genius. I mean, between you've got James Brown, you've got Cab Calloway, you've got Aretha Franklin, who plays the diner owner, which you with your dry white toast, your four fried chickens, it's such a great, great movie. And I think I watched this last week. This is another one that's on cable all the time. And you say one-liners, and this is... Geez, this is probably 2.5 hours, 2 hours and 45 minutes. The movie just goes. It goes right from the beginning, Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis. And that's a line that I use even when I'm talking to, if somebody ever brings up the word Nazi, I say I hate Illinois Nazis. It's just a fantastic movie. And this movie, if I'm correct, didn't really do so well when it first opened. People, I for whatever reason, I guess they didn't take to it. And then within a couple of years after it was released, and probably with cable, the explosion of cable television, this movie really caught a whole new life to it. And you go back, and this is in my top 20 movies of all time. It's that good of a movie from start to finish. We talked about car chases. This is it. I mean, that car chase scene when they're going through the mall, holy cow.
Yeah. This mall has everything.
Pure, exactly.
Pier 1 imports. Looks like the new Oldsmobiles are in early this year. Here's another thing I want to mention, and this is something we bring up all the time. The number of great character actors in this movie. James Brown, Ray Charles, the guys in the band. You got Carrie Fisher playing John Belushi's spurned girlfriend. Henry Gibson plays the head of the Illinois Nazis. Here's someone I want to mention. I like pointing out people that are great character actors that don't get enough love. Kathleen Freeman plays Sister Mary Stigmata. She's the head of the parish or the church where the Blues Brothers grew up. And the scene where she speaks to the boys about how the church is going to need some money to avoid getting, repossessed because of taxes and, how they failed him. And she whips up a wicked ruler on the knuckles of the boys, and the movie is hilarious. It's in parts profane. The opening scene with Frank Oz, who plays the prison guard, who's primarily known as a voice actor. I believe he did the voice of Fozzie Bear on The Muppets. But when he's returning John Belushi's property to him, and John Belushi left a little gift for the prison staff when he checked in, and now that he's checked out, it's remaining in property, and it's picked up with a pair of, needle-nose pliers or something, so they have to – I won't spoil it, but if you've never seen it, it's very, very funny. The Blues Brothers, it's complete mayhem. It's a movie that has a very elongated car chase, as Barry mentioned. I have to tell you that I read when the movie was filmed – John Landis, part of the reason it wasn't perceived as being really popular was they had gone way over budget when they made this movie. The car chase, there must be a minimum of 200 cars that are destroyed in the chase. One of the things I love, very subtle things in movies. I love the scene when they're in the middle of the chase. They're driving back to Chicago in the middle of the night. They've got about 50 cop cars behind them. And they cut away to a scene where Elwood, played by Dan Aykroyd, is driving. And he nudges John Belushi, who's falling asleep in the middle of this car chase. They're being chased by 50 cop cars, and Belushi's character falls asleep. And he wakes up and goes, hey, I got to pull over. I got to pull up. So in the middle of the car chase, he finds the need to pull over to take a whiz. But John Candy is in it as the probation officer. Oh, I can't even begin to say how many great people are in this movie. Go ahead.
Yeah, it absolutely is too. So, and musically, so we're talking about, you know, this is, if you like blues in any form, between Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, Cab Calloway, John Lee Hooker, I believe is in here. But what's your, I know what mine is. What's your favorite musical number from this movie?
You kind of put me on the spot there. I'm probably gonna have to go with Aretha singing Think in the diner. Better think about the
great thing. Yeah.
About the consequences of your actions.
Yeah, so mine's probably a little off, but it's rolling, 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 keep those doggies rolling. When they do the theme from Rawhide behind the cage, the fence, the chicken wire, and they're throwing the beer bottles, and they come out and they get booed. They play Rawhide two or three times, then they do a Stand By Your Man. You know, I think that whole scene in there, and then with Bob obviously showing up, and you know, we're the good old boys. Yeah, just a fantastic movie. If you've never seen this movie, this is your moment. Stop what you're doing. Don't even okay. Listen to the rest of the podcast. But after that, go out. Make sure you're able to see this film.
Well, the scene you're talking about is when they're at Bob's country bunker, and Bob was played by an actor named Jeff Morris, who really didn't do a lot. But the guy that is their nemesis in the movie was played by Charles Napier, is Tucker McElroy, who's the lead singer of the Good Old Boys country and western act. The Blues Brothers, of course, steal their performance because the Good Old Boys were late. But now that I rethink, I think my favorite musical interlude in this movie is hearing John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd sing Tammy Wynette's country classic, Stand By Your Man. And you mentioned it briefly. And part of the reason that it was so great and I loved it so much is this movie came out right around the time that John Travolta's Urban Cowboy was out. So the whole country rock, country pop thing was very big. If you ever listen to like the 80s countdown on Sirius Satellite Radio, and they do like 1980, 1981, there's always tons of country songs in the listing because Urban Cowboy was such a popular movie. And it's hilarious to hear the former VJs talk about, oh yeah, here's a song by the Oak Ridge Boys. We really didn't play much of their stuff on MTV. But so you had the Blues Brothers doing this spoof. It's basically a spoof of Stand By Your Man. And what happens is as they're singing the song, they do the cutaways to the crowd at the bar. And you see the country, you know, country western fans are like crying because they're singing this country standard. And it's such a shot at people that are into country and western. And because that movie was so overplayed, Urban Cowboys music was so overplayed in the top 40 charts. If you weren't a fan of that genre at the time, it was the perfect skewer to everybody that was a country and western fan because it was really poking fun at them and that particular scene. Tremendous film. I agree with Barry. Go out and check it out. Not sooner, or not later, but sooner. Definitely you need to check that out. Okay, Barry. Number seven.
So
I'm keeping up.
You are. You're good because I'm already lost. I know we're going to get called out, but so number seven for me, Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off. You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk? I know what you're thinking. Did he fire six shots or only five? It's the original Dirty Harry. So this is such a guy movie. You know, there's a killer calling himself the Scorpio Killer, and he's menacing San Francisco, and Police Inspector Harry Callahan is assigned to track him down and take him out. And, you know, I remember seeing this for the first time as well, and I remember just going, oh, my God, this is the coolest movie I have ever seen. And the guy playing Dirty Harry, I'm not sure I even knew what his name was, is probably the coolest guy ever. And it still plays to this day. There are certain movies, you know, and this movie is 45, 46 years old, that really are dated. You can watch Dirty Harry right now, and it still will just hold you to the screen. And, you know, a couple of trivia notes with this one, too. So with Dirty Harry, he's really the character of Harry Callahan is known for Go Ahead, Make My Day. Did you know that actually came from Sudden Impact in 1983? I don't think I ever knew that.
I think Ronald Reagan stole that line from a Dirty Harry movie.
Yeah. That's 100% correct. I think you're 100% right. So I love Dirty Harry. You know, he could do nothing wrong. The guy who played the Scorpio Killer is a guy that, without giving anything away, is also going to be on your list in one of your movies coming up shortly. I am pretty sure of that fact.
That's true.
And I won't say anything else. It is true, absolutely. And he's another one, too, that is he's a great character actor. He's in a ton of work. You may not know him by name, but when you see the face, you go, oh, yeah, I know that guy. I exactly know who that guy is. So what do you think about Dirty Harry?
Well, I'll tell you a little trivia. Barry and I have mentioned so far in the show a comparison to the movie Zodiac, which came out, I want to say, early to mid-2000s. And it's a tremendous movie, very disturbing movie, about the hunt for the Zodiac Killer in San Francisco. This movie, a lot of this movie was about the hunt for the Zodiac Killer in San Francisco. You have a killer whose name is Scorpio. And one of the scenes in the movie, the killer hijacks a school bus full of kids, which is something that the Zodiac Killer had threatened to do in letters to the San Francisco Chronicle. Did you know that, Barry?
I did know that. So I so
well, fine.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, in one of my hobbies is I do tend to look at you know, stories like the Zodiac Killer. I think I've seen every movie on it, but yeah, I did know that. But yeah, it was based off that, absolutely.
Yeah. And you're right, the actor that played the lead heel in this movie is such an iconic performance, and I'm going to give you the actor's name later in my list because he comes up again in a performance in one of my movies that's more towards the top of my list. I had read that the performance was so well done by this guy playing the crazed serial killer, the Scorpio, in this movie, that he had trouble getting roles afterwards because people thought the actor was legitimately nuts.
Actually makes a lot of sense, because when you stop and look at that as well, he was so strong in this movie, and even the movie that you're going to mention in a little bit, he's a really strong performer. He kind of steals scenes when he's in them. And I always wondered, much like we're talking, why wasn't this guy a bigger star?
Sure, sure. So, okay, time for my number 7 movie, is it, Barry?
Yeah.
Okay, I think so. Just double checking. My number 7 movie is a movie that is really two parts of one movie. The beginning part takes place in a Marine boot camp, and the second part takes place in Vietnam, and it is Stanley Kubrick's epic vision of the horrors of Vietnam called Full Metal Jacket. And primarily, it's an amazing, amazing work of filmmaking by Stanley Kubrick. But here's what I want to focus on mainly when it comes to Full Metal Jacket. Full Metal Jacket, Matthew Modine, Vincent D'Onofrio, Adam Baldwin, great cast. But the guy, when the movie's over, that everyone walks out the theater talking about is a guy named Arlie Ermey. And Arlie Ermey plays the drill sergeant in the movie. His name is Sergeant Hartman. Sergeant Hartman is the DI for the young recruits that are going through boot camp. And it is probably one of the scariest, most hilarious, if I can use those two words together, performances I'm talking in the history of cinema. It is a crime that Arlie Ermey, for his performance in this movie, was not at least nominated for an Academy Award. That's how strong and how memorable this performance is. Let me just leave you with a little bit of Arlie Ermey from this movie. And this is going to be not safe for work, folks. I got to tell you. So tune this out for the kiddies. This is Gunnery Sergeant Hartman's opening speech to the new recruits. If you ladies leave my island, if you survive recruit training, you will be a weapon. You will be a minister of death praying for war. But until that day, you are pukes. You are the lowest form of life on Earth. You are not human fucking beings. You are nothing but unorganized, grabastic pieces of amphibian shit. Because I am hard, you will not like me. But the more you hate me, the more you will learn. I am hard, but I am fair. There is no racial bigotry here. I do not look down on niggers, kikes, wobster, greasers. Here you are all equally worthless. And my orders are to weed out all the non-hackers who do not pack the gear to serve in my beloved Corps. Do you maggots understand that? And it just goes on from that, folks. He spends the better part of an hour in this movie verbally abusing with every foul language curse word that you can think, some that I'd never even heard of at this point, but it's completely epic. And what it was Arlie Ermey was actually a real life drill instructor who they brought onto the movie just for professional advice on how they should handle the role. Kubrick fell in love with the guy and made him a guy that I believe had never acted in another movie before this. And he's subsequently become a very well-known character actor, but he was a guy that had never acted before. He basically played himself, the tough-nosed drill instructor, foul-mouthed, trying to weed out the guys that weren't going to make it in the war. And, you know, famously, I have to tell you, because my brother and my father both served time in the military, you know, the old saying is, when the military gets you, what they do is they break you down and then they build you back up. And Arlie Ermey's basic requirement, his job, is to break down every single recruit and then to build them back up. The ones he builds back up will become Marines and fighting men in war. And the ones that fall apart, they're going to get kicked out of the Corps. His performance is so epic and so incredible. The back half of this movie is great, but it can't compare to the front part, which is one of the most stellar pieces of filmmaking I've ever seen. The performance by Arlie Ermey is so epic. Google YouTube just to watch that scene if you have to, if you don't want to watch the whole movie, because it's so good. It's so hilariously scary the way he verbally browbeats these poor recruits, Matthew Modine and Vincent D'Onofrio. Vincent D'Onofrio becomes his personal whipping boy, and it's just absolutely epic. Barry?
Yeah, it's a great movie, too. So what you just said, too, I remember seeing this in the theater, and when you walked out of the theater, you remember Arlie Ermey, and you remember Vincent D'Onofrio. The Matthew Modine character was, in my opinion, kind of like a Seinfeld character. He was kind of the straight man for all the people around him.
So, Sergeant Joker, or Private Joker.
Private Joker. So, yeah, it was D'Onofrio was frightening in this role, and he's just I think he's a fantastic actor. But this really belongs to Arlie Ermey, and you're right. And it was kind of bizarre because he got a career when this movie was done. He appeared in a lot of movies and TV shows, but he never reached those heights what I actually thought he was going to be reaching. This is a great movie, though, and they're all still acting. Matthew Modine is a recurring character on Stranger Things, the Netflix show. D'Onofrio still does movies, and Arlie Ermey, he's doing commercials. I want to say he was doing a car insurance commercial or something as of a year ago I saw him. So this is a very good movie. This is probably my second favorite. It's my second favorite Stanley Kubrick movie. Sometimes it can be one. I have three that I'm right there with, but this is really an epic film. And this is the difference between a filmmaker that looks to create art versus a guy making a movie. Because every scene is really crafted in such a way. So I love this movie. It's an excellent choice.
Yeah. And the second part of the movie, when they're actually in Vietnam, it's very, surreal. Like what they're going through when the group of soldiers gets pinned down by a sniper, and the way that scene plays out and the big plot reveal at the end of that particular scene is really epic. And by no means am I poo-pooing the second part of the movie, because this movie in total is an absolute work of art. Barry's absolutely right. But just that first part of the movie, the first hour when Arlie Ermey has a hold of these recruits and is totally weeding them out by verbally browbeating them in a way. It's funny. Last week we were talking about A Christmas Story, and we were talking, and there was a scene in there where Darren McGavin's character is cursing, and the narrator, at looking back on his father, the old man, says he weaved a tapestry of vulgarities that still may be hanging over Lake Michigan. And in this movie, Arlie Ermey weaves vulgarities and curse words like Shakespeare. I mean, it's just a tapestry of vulgarities and cursing, and please God, don't ever turn this movie on at work, because you'll end up getting terminated. But that being said, he completely owned this role. He found some work doing, playing the drill sergeant. He got stereotyped for a little while. I remember he was also in a movie. This is a real B movie called The Siege of Firebase Gloria. I don't know if you ever saw that one. Great war movie.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, he plays same kind of role. He plays the tough sergeant that's got to, get the guys through this siege at a particular base in Vietnam. But another great movie. Okay, Barry, Enough of that brilliant Kubrick film. Let's get to your number six.
Another tough one for me. So let me do this. You want to fuck with me? Okay. You want to play rough? Okay. Say hello to my little friend. What movie am I talking about?
I'm guessing you might be talking about Scarface, but I'm not totally sure.
Yeah, you're 100% sure. I'm talking about Scarface. And really, it was a movie that was filmed in Miami and South Florida, and you and I were both living there at the time, and it was pretty accurate. Yeah, the accent that that Al Pacino had as Tony Montana sometimes wavered. But at the same time, this movie is a movie that has gigantic balls. And this is, in my opinion, a guy's movie. My wife sees it on, and whether it's the opening scene when the guy's getting hacked up in the bathtub with a chainsaw, or whether it's the scene where, the very ending when Al Pacino is snorting up all the coke and has got the guns and just going completely insane. But I love this movie, and pardon me. I've seen Scarface so many times, and Scarface was one of those movies that I saw with a group of friends when it first came out in 1983, and it was such a popular movie, and really still is. It's got this cult-like following, and I remember I moved to New York in, I guess it was February or March of 1984, and Scarface was still playing on the screens up there, and it wasn't playing in the first-run movie theaters. It was playing possibly in the second-run theaters, but people were still going, and people were actually talking back to the screen when he was saying certain lines. There's that one scene where he's with Michelle Pfeiffer, and it's the reason she can't get pregnant, and your womb is polluted, and there were people actually screaming the line at the screen. So I think Scarface is a great movie. It's definitely a guy's movie. My wife never wants me to ever put this on, but it's so entertaining. There's so much good about it. I love seeing Stephen Bauer in this movie, and Stephen Bauer is kind of a Miami guy. He was also in that great show Ray Donovan, which if anybody watches Ray Donovan, he played what did he play? What was the guy's name? The Israeli.
You
watch Ray Donovan?
I watched the first season of Ray Donovan, and I haven't watched this. I haven't watched it since because I realized. Every character in Ray Donovan is pretty despicable. That's why I stopped watching the movie or the TV show.
But they're all pretty bad. I mean, they're absolutely all pretty bad. But it's going to kill me if I can't think of what his name is in that show. But he plays an Israeli, and he actually does a decent job with the accent. But, Michelle Pfeiffer's in this. Another great character actor, Robert Loggia, is in this movie. F. Murray Abraham is in this movie. There's just so many people, and it's so well crafted. I'm not going to say this is a great movie, from a technical aspect, because there are definitely a lot of flaws. But this is also a Brian De Palma movie, and we've been talking about De Palma. This is one of his films, so I love it.
Yeah, the character that Stephen Bauer plays is Avi.
Avi, thank you. Yeah, I was going to say it was something, but yeah, it's Avi. So well, that's a great show, Ray Donovan. You're not the first person that has said that to me about about it jumping the shark after the first or second season. And I thought this season was just phenomenal, actually.
So I will tell you that when Scarface first came out, and the first time I saw it, I completely hated this movie. I completely hated it, number one, because living in South Florida, both of us, as you discussed, first of all, I can tell you that there's no Cuban people named Montana. That bothered me. Second thing is no Cuban people talk like he talks in this movie until, then after the movie came out, the Cubans started taking on that affectation as a joke. But yeah. I worked in Hialeah when this movie came out and nobody talked like that. And I thought that Pacino's performance, there's a lot of great character actors, like you mentioned, Robert Loggia. That's another guy that's a great character actor, Stephen Bauer. But to me, Pacino's performance in this movie was so over the top ridiculous that it really kind of flawed the movie for me. Now, since that being said, I've seen the movie recently within the last year or two, and I gained more of an appreciation for the movie as, basically it is what it is sort of thing. If you accept it with that, it's fun. You know, it's so parts of it are so ridiculous that you're right. The go home scene where he's got his face in the big pile of coke and he's just, you know, out of his mind on cocaine. That's great stuff. But when it first came out, I wasn't a huge fan. Again, like you said, great Brian De Palma, a great director, did so many, you know, really good works. This would not have been in my top Pacino films. I think it's Pacino basically as a characterization of himself. You know, one of the things I've read is Pacino, the way his voice has changed over time and his movies in the, you know, the 80s and 90s, he did a lot of screaming, you know, hoo-yah, hoo-yah, and stuff like that. So, but I completely understand why, you know, people can see Scarface as this tremendous film. It's definitely a film that most guys have on their list because of the excess and the way he spends all his ill-gotten gain, the way he goes to excess with the drugs themselves. And yeah, so I mean, I get it. I get it being on your list.
And you just said it too. So it's the excess of the movie. It is over the top. Al Pacino, I'm not going to say this is a great artistic performance. At the same time, it's over the top. It's almost a caricature of what we would say if I asked, you know, if I asked my 13-year-old daughter and I gave her direction to be an over the top Cuban drug dealer, it's almost like she could do this in a sense because there's nothing realistic about it in any form. It doesn't make any sense. That being said, it is just so much fun, though, and it's because he is over the top. And that end scene, you know, the coke, the guns, it's just awesome. And there's some really good action scenes as well, like when they're in the disco and there's the hit out on him, you know, when that takes place, and then he goes to see Robert Loggia, and that whole scene, you know, and I don't want to give away too much again, no spoilers after 34 years, but at the same time, you know, nobody will ever confuse this with a great work of art. The same time, this is a really fun, kind of dumb movie.
Well, and that's what we're looking for, fun, dumb movies, guy movies.
That's what we're all about.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things you talked about, how this movie had was about excess. I'm sure it's not a coincidence that the person that was the screenwriter on this movie was Oliver Stone, who apparently, when this film was being made, was having some substance abuse problems of his own, which may have played a part in, you know, why this was such a, you know, historic mess of a movie on the screen and I think off, too.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right about that too, and you know, so again, when we did the documentaries, you know, about a month or so ago, and we talked about Cocaine Cowboys, you know, that was obviously was a documentary, so there was a lot of things that were accurate, but even when you watch this movie, you know, there's a lot. You know, I remember being at the Fountain Blue and seeing guys like this. I remember going to the pool there, and there were guys like this going. You know, it's. This was the South Florida culture. Again, this is almost a characterization of it, but this was the South Florida culture in the first half of the decade of the 1980s, without a doubt.
And it's amazing if you lived in South Florida at the time, the way that the culture of the South Florida communities, including Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Palm Beach, the way things changed after Mariel and the Mariel boat lift and you know, they talked about Castro dumping out his prisons and sending them all over on boats to South Florida. And while that was not 100% accurate, there was some validity. There was a percentage of guys that were basically criminals that came over and created the crime culture that existed, you know, in South Florida at the time, whether it was with the Cubans, with the Colombians. You know, we talked about in our documentary, the Cocaine Cowboys, that all initiated this. This movie takes place in the time frame of Cocaine Cowboys. And that was the culture. And every night, as I said, when we were talking about Cocaine Cowboys, every night on the news, there was some kind of horrific murder that was drug related that was happening in Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Palm Beach.
Yeah. Nope. You're right, man.
So I'm up. Oh God, Barry, help me. Am I at 6 or 5? I feel ashamed.
6.
6. Okay. My number 6 movie, the greatest golf movie of all time, without question, is Caddyshack. Caddyshack is the slobs versus the snobs. That was the tagline of the movie. We mentioned Brian Doyle Murray earlier. Brian Doyle Murray was one of the primary writers of this movie. And this movie is all about the genius of Bill Murray, Rodney Dangerfield, Ted Knight, Chevy Chase, I think to a lesser extent, because the over the top funny stuff was the aforementioned Rodney, Bill Murray, just so many great performances, so many great lines. But, you know, Bill Murray as the groundskeeper out to get the menacing gopher. The gopher was so ridiculous. It was like a stuffed toy playing the role of a gopher. Just so over the top, a great Kenny Loggins song, and the stuff with the young kid that I'm now drawing, of course, a complete blank on. What's his name? Michael O'Keefe. I'm sorry. Michael O'Keefe and Sarah Holcomb, who had a very good supporting role in Animal House. And here she plays Maggie, the Irish girl who thinks she's knocked up. And another great supporting role, Scott Columbo, always played the greasy, you know, low life kind of teenage kid. And he plays the same thing in this movie. Barry, I know Caddyshack's got to be one of your favorite comedies of all time.
Yeah, it is. So, too, if we're talking classic comedies, it comes down to three for me. And I'll be honest, it's Animal House, it's Stripes. Actually, it's four. It's Blues Brothers and it's Caddyshack. See, I can count. It was 3 to 4. So Caddyshack does fall into it. I'll tell you a funny story about Caddyshack. So I've mentioned previously as well that my father managed a furniture store in South Florida called Levitt's. You'll love it at Levitt's. And one of the things he would do was they would actually loan furniture whenever they were filming movies in the area. And Caddyshack was one of those. We actually got to go on set, and the scene has the big explosion, which I think is towards the end of the movie. We actually got to watch that being filmed. So it was kind of cool. I love Caddyshack. I think it is great. You mentioned some great character actors. Sarah Holcomb, if you remember her, she played the girl who was underaged in Animal House. And she was the one where Tom Hulce is there and he's got the devil on one shoulder and an angel on another shoulder. And should he touch her or not touch her? And in this movie, you know, she's great. But have you ever Googled her to see what she's actually up to now?
Not lately. She didn't do much after these two roles, did she?
She didn't. So apparently she had some sort of mental breakdown. I believe she was from Ireland, and she's basically been AWOL for a couple of decades at least. But I thought she was great in both these movies. Ted Knight, I don't think you mentioned Ted Knight. He was just great. Just such a goof, you know, such a kind of a bumbling bad guy. And Chevy Chase is his nephew, and I just, you know, this is such a fun movie. You know, and Bill Murray with the Gophers, you know, it's just great.
Say au revoir, Gophers. My favorite Ted Knight line in this movie is he plays a judge in the movie and he's in the office with Michael O'Keefe, who plays a kid named Danny, who's trying to hit him up for a scholarship. And so Ted Knight is sitting down and giving advice to Danny. And he says, you know, Danny, I've sentenced boys younger than you to the gas chamber. Didn't want to do it. I felt I owed it to them. And that's just such a disturbing line, but in such a hilarious way. And, you know, his boat, I dubbed thee the Flying Wasp, you know, there's just, and Rodney, oh my God. You know, we talked about Rodney before, Back to School, Easy Money. Yeah. Rodney in this movie is just throwing the one-liners out. Al Cervic is his name. And he's a land developer, golf courses, biggest waste of prime real estate I've ever seen in my life. And he's just throwing lines out. Hey, you must have been something before electricity, huh? Yeah. So
Did you see Caddyshack 2?
No, I would not waste my time. I knew it was going to be a disaster. Didn't want to see it.
It's such a disaster, though, that it almost requires you to watch it because it literally is the overturned car on the highway that you have to slow down to see what happened because Jackie Mason goes into the Rodney Dangerfield role. It's so bizarre. And Jackie Mason, whatever you think of him, he's no Rodney Dangerfield. There's no way he's going to pull it off. It's really bizarre. But I would say, you know, Caddyshack, if you've never seen it, in my opinion, it's right up there with Stripes as far as a comedy, as far as a classic comedy. It's right there.
Yeah, tremendous. Okay, what's your next one?
So my next one, can you dig it? and you know exactly what that means. That is 1979's The Warriors. And this is such a guy's movie, though I feel that the women can watch this. But essentially, this is where this charismatic leader named Cyrus invites all of the street gangs of New York City to come together to take over New York. And while this is happening, somebody kills Cyrus. And one of the gangs then blames the Warriors, and the Warriors have to fight through all this, and they have to get home to their home in Brooklyn. And it is the movie is literally about them having to go through all these different subway stops and all these different areas and having to fight all of these gangs to get home. And I, when I first saw this movie, and I saw it when it came out in the theaters, I was like 15 years old, and it was actually creating this buzz in Florida because there were fights breaking out, and a lot of it was all media created, but apparently fights were breaking out, and there had been gunshots and stabbings and all this, and I didn't give a shit. I was still going to go see this movie. So I've seen the movie. I've seen it many times. You know, there's some great lines in the movie. Luther, you know, who is played by the great, you know, one of the great character actors, and a guy who was in Commando as well, which is Daniel Patrick Kelly. And he's clicking the beer bottles together with his fingers, and he's, "Warriors, come out to play, yay!" And it's super creepy. Like, it just super, just is super creepy when he's doing it. And that guy would come into my restaurant in New York when I was managing the restaurants, and he was a real nice guy, had a younger wife, kind of a smoking hot younger wife, and was really friendly with everybody. Wasn't, you know, in every movie he's ever been in, Commando and this and everything else he's ever done, he was in that movie Dreamscape, if you remember that, with Dennis Quaid and Christopher Plummer. He's always played a douchebag.
Wasn't he in 48 Hours?
Yeah, and he was in 48 Hours, exactly. Yeah, so he's been in a bunch of movies, but he plays almost the same kind of whiny, runty, douchebag, unlikable character, which in real life he was nothing like that. And apparently he's like a black belt in karate. But I love this movie, and I'm going to say, I know you've seen this movie, because really, you know, what guy hasn't seen this movie? But let me ask you a couple of trivia questions. First off, what's your favorite gang in this movie?
No question, my favorite gang is the Baseball Furies.
I knew you were gonna, that's what everybody said. I knew you were going to say that. Do you know how many gangs were in this movie?
Let's see.
I didn't know. I had to Google it, so it's not like okay. I'm like a genius of any.
Well, I'm trying to think right off the top of my head. We got the Baseball Furies. We got the Warriors, of course. We got the Gramercy Riffs. Yeah. We got the Lezzies. We got.
It's actually the Lizzies.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Right, but they were my favorite. So as
wait. I'm trying to think. Then we had the low rent gang. I think it was what were they called, like the Vandals or something like that. What was the low rent gang where they met the girl and the guy goes, hey, we got a rep.
I think that was the Van Cortlandt Rangers. Anyways, there are 21 gangs. Which is kind of actually the Electric Eliminators might have also been, but there are 21 gangs. But getting back to the Lizzies, so I remember being 15 and watching that scene when the Warriors go back to the hangout of the Lizzies, and they're all just kind of sitting around. And this is before any, you know, before the fighting started. But I remember thinking to myself, God, I wish I was one of these Warriors, like these really hot, like Puerto Rican Dominican chicks in here. But this was such a fun movie. And then there was, remember the guys on the roller skates? It just, the whole movie was just great. And it's kind of taken on its own life. You know, even in wrestling, Booker T, in the Harlem Heat, can you dig it, sucka? You know, they definitely took it from this movie. So I must have seen this movie when it came out. I think I went to the theater, and I can remember exactly where I saw it, at the Sky Lake Movie Theater. And I saw it two or three times. And then once it hit cable, I think it was just repeated viewings. A lot of fun. And these guys also make the circuit. They do the MonsterCon and pop culture convention circuit, signing autographs and taking photos. So pretty cool.
You know, I was thinking the gang we're talking about on roller skates, I thought those were the Van Cortlandt boys. Am I remembering that wrong?
No, you might be right too. I can't get with 21 gangs. Again, I have a real fucking problem with counting, obviously. So with 21 gangs, I'm not sure who's what and who's where. But I do remember the Baseball Furies because they really stood out. There were the Orphans too.
The Orphans. That's the low rent gang. The Orphans. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the Lizzies, of course. I'll never forget the Lizzies. The Hi-Hats I remember, too, because they were the guys wearing those hats, those kind of Hispanic-style hat, if there's such a thing. I love this movie.
So, okay, my number five movie, keeping a good numerical track of our order here, is a movie I believe Barry and I have discussed on more than one occasion. It is a movie that came out in 1986, and it stars the great James Hong, who we mentioned in one of the other episodes. It's a movie called Big Trouble in Little China. And Kurt Russell plays Jack Burton, a truck driver who gets involved with some people in Chinatown who owe him some money. And so he literally, much like Alice, goes down the rabbit hole and discovers a part of Chinatown that he never knew existed. This is a action fantasy where he is after this Chinese gang lord named David Lo Pan. And I'm sitting here trying to struggle how to describe this movie, because Kurt Russell had never played a role like this. He was a guy that was well known for being a Disney character and, you know, a guy that in his teenage years had just done all these family-friendly movies. And then after he, you know, got into making, you know, The Thing and a more adult type of movies. But Kurt Russell was never seen as an action film star. And he made this movie, which was so crazy, a karate, fist fights, trucks, you know, car chases. And it's one of these movies that when you see it, you keep wondering, how are they going to top what they just did 5 minutes ago? Oh, yeah, they just did. It involves sorcery, witchcraft, underground San Francisco, Chinatown. Barry, have I missed anything?
No, the name of his truck is the Pork Chop Express.
That's right.
For some reason, I always got the biggest kick. I love this movie. This is another one that if it wasn't on your list, I probably would have put it on my list. We were trying to do separate movies so we could each have 10. Just a great movie. I know that they're remaking it with Dwayne Johnson, and as much as I love Dwayne Johnson and the whole Johnson family, this movie should never be remade. It was a classic. David Lo Pan, the great James Hong, another guy that does a lot of these fan conventions that I'm praying I get to meet him at some point because I just think he's so cool. But I like the scene when they go into the brothel and you've got the three wizards who are the different elements. Do you remember this scene?
Yeah, and the one wizard, to me, looks like Jumbo Saruta. I don't know why.
100%.
Yeah.
He looks just like Jumbo Saruta as well. It's really insane, but I really like the way that this movie was directed too. And I think John Carpenter has got such a vision, and he directs some really interesting movies. And, you know, even with the movie Halloween, which is this iconic horror film, the way that he does his camera work and the way he focuses on everything. And you bring up, you know, to me, you really describe the movie extremely well because it really is going through the rabbit hole. And he created this set, which is underground San Francisco, but it's very bizarre. It's very dark and it's very unique. So I think this is a great movie. I 1986. I remember seeing this in the theater as well. But it's one that I have on my DVR. I've got a DVD copy, and I'll watch it once or twice a year at least.
Yeah, tremendous fun. Great way to kill a Saturday afternoon. Barry, give me your number four.
Wow, number four. So I'm going to give you a quote. Listen, kid. I'm not going to bullshit you, all right? I don't give a good fuck what you know or you don't know, but I'm going to torture you anyways, regardless. Not to get information. It's amusing to me to torture a cop. You can say anything you want because I've heard it all before. All you can do is pray for a quick death, which you ain't going to get. You ever listen to K. Billy's Super Sounds of the 70s Weekend? It's my personal favorite. And then he puts on Steeler's Wheel Stuck in the Middle with You. So it's Reservoir Dogs. And this is This was a tough one for me, only because I was going to put a Tarantino film on my list, and I didn't want to put four Tarantino films. That didn't seem right. But at the same token, I could put every Tarantino film on this list. So I went with the one which kind of brought me to the dance, which is Reservoir Dogs. And again, I remember seeing this film. I know exactly where I saw it. I saw it in Fort Lauderdale. And if you remember, when this movie came out, there was kind of a big stink in South Florida. And they were actually, they were putting these warning signs on the window when you went to buy tickets, and it was, we will offer no refunds. Please note, this is, I think it was either not rated or rated X. And a lot of it had to do with the scene that I just described, which is the great scene when he's got this guy tied up into a chair. It's a cop. And Michael Madsen, who is Mr. Blonde, is torturing him and cutting his ear with a straight razor. At the same time, he's dancing to Steeler's Wheel, Stuck in the Middle with You. It's an iconic scene for a film. So this whole movie is great. I really think this is great from start to finish. It's my favorite Tarantino film, but that's like saying, you know, my favorite pizza in a sense. I love pizza. I love Tarantino films. So I love it. At the same time, this could have been Pulp Fiction. It could have been The Hateful Eight. I don't know if it could have been Jackie Brown, but possibly it could have. But I love Reservoir Dogs from start to finish. And I should say, It's got Chris Penn, which, you know, Chris Penn, I think, was an underrated actor, believable as this bad guy bully. And, you know, it's got Harvey Keitel, and Tim Roth plays a great character. And no spoiler here, Tim Roth gets shot early on in the movie and basically is bleeding to death throughout the entire movie. And a lot of it is centered around that. So Reservoir Dogs for me, big thumbs up.
Okay. As you're sitting here telling the story, I'm thinking, okay, I just remembered. The one guy you forgot was Lawrence Tierney. Lawrence Tierney was sort of the head of the gang that was going to commit this robbery. Lawrence Tierney, if you don't remember his work going back into the 40s and 50s in film noir, you Seinfeld fans will remember he played Elaine's dad in Seinfeld.
And he has one of the best lines ever. Pipe down, choir boy, which I just think is great.
What is the song that gets stuck in his head? What is it? Something of the house. Da, 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 where he starts singing that stupid song and it gets in your head.
Master of the house.
Master of the house. Right. That's what it was. Okay. So a couple of things off the top of the head. Do you ever get a chance to look at a magazine called Empire Magazine that's available on newsstands in like Barnes & Noble and stuff like that? Have you ever heard of that?
Is it a nudie magazine?
No. Empire Magazine is a movie magazine. They cover DVD releases back when DVDs were a thing, but they look at upcoming movies. They also do retrospectives, and it just so happens that this month's issue, which I picked up today, does a retrospective on Reservoir Dogs. So you're definitely going to have to seek that out. And, you know, looking at the making of the film and all the little oddities and cultural little nuances. This is when you were talking about that the scene where Michael Madsen cuts off the cop's ear. I love the fact, and this is very dark and twisted, when he does that and then he walks to the other side of the room, turns his back on the cop and holds his ear, the severed ear, up to his mouth and goes, can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Yeah. The ear, it's very dark and twisted. Quentin Tarantino, I tell you a movie you forgot to mention. That's not a Tarantino directed film, but we recently spoke to each other about the movie True Romance, which Tarantino wrote. And that's got one of the great movie fights. There's another podcast episode, Great Movie Fights. The fight between Patricia Arquette and James Gandolfini is a tremendous fight in that movie. That's another great Tarantino film. But this one, I tell you what I love about this movie. I love the opening scene where they're sitting around and they're talking at a diner table, having breakfast, drinking coffee. And they start talking about the minutiae of life. And I believe one of the things we're talking about is the old TV show, Get Christie Love. And am I right about that? And that's the kind of stuff that's the real genius of Tarantino, more than as a filmmaker, as a writer, is that he has these – if you remember in Pulp Fiction, them talking about what they call, you know, the Whopper and what they call the Big Mac in Europe. Just stupid minutiae, things like that. And it becomes so interesting in the hands of a great writer like Tarantino that he's able to delve into things so seemingly obscure that no one would notice it and make it into an interesting topic. Completely fascinating. Great movie. Bloody, violent, not for the squeamish at all times, needless to say, based on, you know, what you spoke of, but just an incredible work of filmmaking as art in a violent way by Tarantino.
Absolutely. So to touch on two things you just said, you nailed it on the head. You were spot on. Tarantino's dialogue is arguably the best in of anybody. In every movie, he does it. He did it in Kill Bill, where there's a conversation between David Carradine and Uma Thurman where they're discussing superheroes, and it's Superman versus Batman, for maybe 10 minutes. And they just go through these really minute details. But the opening scene also, with the one where they're talking about Christy Love, that's the whole tip scene, if you remember. And then Steve Buscemi, Mr. Pink, says, well, I don't believe in tips. And then Harvey Keitel says, what the fuck do you mean you don't believe in tips? And that goes on for 5 minutes. And these are dialogues that are believable. They're super real. That's a conversation you could see somebody having. I love it, and you really were spot on as far as Tarantino. His writing is just phenomenal.
Yeah. So, okay, my next movie, number four, came out in 1982. You know, during the 80s, you think about action films, and you think about guys like Chuck Norris. The previous decade was Charles Bronson, Clint Eastwood. In the 80s, you had Schwarzenegger, Stallone, Jean-Claude Van Damme, made a couple of pretty decent movies, not a lot of great movies. There was a few that were good. But the Chuck Norris movie that I want to talk about at number four, I think is the best Chuck Norris movie, and it's called Code of Silence. And we discussed earlier when we were talking about Raiders of the Lost Ark, and we got into a discussion about the Harrison Ford movie that I'm now drawing a complete blank on. the Fugitive, I'm sorry. And shot in Chicago. Here, instead of Chicago, Chuck Norris plays a cop named Eddie Cusack, and Eddie Cusack is trying to bring down a Colombian drug lord who's played epically by Henry Silva. Henry Silva was also in a movie that you mentioned earlier. Completely forgot about Sharky's Machine. That would have been in my top 10. That's a great, great movie set in Atlanta. But Henry Silva plays a Colombian drug lord who's passing out money and passing out drugs in Chicago. He kills an informant, and Eddie Cusack is basically going against the entire police force who are being, are protecting this Colombian guy. It's got tons of great Chicago character actors in it, including the guy that we mentioned before. One of the guys that's in there, Dennis Farina, is in there. A guy named Ron Dean is a guy that when you see his face, you go, oh, yeah, that guy, because he's in all the movies. And I'm trying to find the guy that was in him. I can't find him. It wasn't Burt Remsen. Burt Remsen was in this movie. He's not the guy that I was talking about earlier, though. The guy that was in the Home Alone movie, the voice actor. You know what I'm talking about, Barry?
Whoa.
That was not Burt Remsen. Burt Remsen is in this movie. But anyway, the reason I like it, and Chuck Norris actually in this movie, believe it or not, in my opinion, acts in this movie. He's not just like a karate guy doing stunts. I mean, he does all that, you know, there's fight scenes and stuff like that. But he plays a really believable cop in this movie. And I thought he really stretched himself out like he didn't before. I really don't think he did after that either. This is just a solid cop movie that you could make it today and it'd still be a really, you know, is it going to win an Academy Award? No. But is it a direct-to-video? Absolutely not. This is the kind of movie that could go and have a life in the movie theaters. Solid cast of veteran actors. Henry Silva is just out of his mind in this movie as the Colombian drug lord. And there's a great scene where he and Chuck Norris is coming in to testify. Henry Silva's walking out. And I believe they're in a courtroom or maybe in the police headquarters. And Henry Silva is trying to threaten Chuck Norris, and he says, you know, there is a custom we have in Colombia. It is called the Colombian necktie. I would like to give this to you as a gift. And Chuck Norris looks at him and says, yeah, well, why don't you give it to me right now? Why don't you give it to me here? Go ahead. And Henry Silva totally backs down. And it's funny that phrase, the Colombian necktie, if you're not familiar with Colombian drug cartel, it's a very heinous way of dying. Let's put it that way. And it's funny because I have a friend of mine from the courthouse who used to be a prosecutor who was Colombian. She was actually the first Colombian-born judge in the United States. She's no longer a judge. She's an attorney down here. And I used to call her when she was in my division as a prosecutor, I called her the Colombian necktie because whatever she tried a case, she won like 100% of them. So I used to say, another victory for the Colombian necktie. So.
And the Colombian necktie, if I'm correct, is they would slit your – this is going to be graphic, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. They would slit your throat and then pull your tongue out through that slit, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Leave your tongue hanging through the slit in your throat.
Yeah, exactly. So this is Chuck's finest work of art. It's his best movie by far. Molly Hagen plays his daughter. And it was really interesting because Molly Hagen went from playing she doesn't play Chuck Norris.
No.
She plays the daughter of the
lead, the informant. Yeah.
Of the informant. But she wound up playing mothers like 2 years later. Like she went literally from playing somebody's daughter and playing mothers like almost immediately. It's a great cast of characters. There's two great scenes which take place in bars, and there's the one where the guys come in to rob the bar, which I just think is awesome.
It's a cop bar.
And to your point that you brought up a couple times, everybody who's in that bar is in every movie that's ever been made in Chicago. Like, all those guys are all right there. You can point them all out. Then there's this scene where Chuck Norris actually goes to a bar and basically kicks the shit out of everybody in the bar. So, this is his best movie. His second best movie, in my opinion, was Invasion USA. But Code of Silence, it wasn't taken as a joke either. I think it was actually released as a real film. And I think it had Chuck Norris, for whatever reason, if he'd stuck on the path of making movies like that, might have been a little more respected as an actor and less of just an action superstar or whatever he was.
And I have to give credit where it's due. The character actor that Barry and I have been talking about is a guy named Ralph Footy. He plays Craigie in this movie. He's also in Home Alone in the scene where, what's the line again from the television set, Barry?
You filthy animals.
Exactly. That's the guy. He was in this. He was in the movie The Package. He, I believe, was in The Fugitive. He's just in tons and tons of movies that are based in Chicago. Great character actor. So,
He's kind of slimy, too.
Exactly. Plays kind of a sleazy guy. You know who he kind of looks like? He looks like an older – do you know who Ryan Stiles is, the comedian?
Who is that?
He's on the – what's the show with Drew Barry? Whose Line Is It Anyway? Is that the show?
Yeah, I don't know if I ever watched. Yeah. I don't know.
No, Ryan Stiles is a comedian that tours the country. He's very, very funny.
Does a lot of
improv. And Craigie looks like an older Ryan Stiles. Tell me if I'm wrong,
Erica. He does it with that guy Colin Mochrie, the improv
star. Yes, exactly. That's
the guy. I know who he is, yep.
So anyway, we are down to, I believe it's your number three.
This is amazing. We have actually, and this makes sense because I do have this abacus directly next to my computer, so I have just been marking these off. So number three for me is, I believe, the only sports-related film on my list, and in my opinion, it's the greatest sports movie of all time, and one of the greatest movies of all time, and one of the greatest guy movies of all time. It's Slapshot. And if you've ever seen Slapshot, I don't need to even say another word, because the first time you see Slapshot, it is arguably the most profane movie in the history of movies. It is super entertaining. It hockey, which I didn't know squat about growing up in Miami Beach as a kid, it introduced me to hockey. And what this movie basically about is Paul Newman is playing. He's this over-the-hill player coach. His name is Reggie Dunlop, and he's running this team called the Charlestown Chiefs. It's somewhere in New England, and attendance sucks. The team sucks. Nobody seems to care. And they kind of get these brothers called the Hanson Brothers, who are these kind of nerdy-looking guys. They all wear these really thick black-rimmed glasses. And they don't look like hockey players, but yet when they get on the ice, they're the most violent thugs the sport has ever seen. And the crowd really takes to them. And all of a sudden, people start coming out to see these guys play. So this is such a great movie, and there's so many great lines. This might even be the first time I ever saw nudity in a film when he's in bed with Hanrahan's wife. played by Lindsay Krause, who is a real actress, by the way, and she's topless. And I remember sitting there going, wow, look at that. And I was, you know, what, 10, 8 years old, so I was pretty young. But there's so many great lines. And, you know, there's the one scene with the Hansen brothers, and they just, these guys love to fight. And the referee goes over to the Hansen brothers and says, I got my eye on the three of you. You pull one thing and you're out of this game. I run a clean game here. I have any trouble here and I'll suspend you. And Steve Hansen looks over and goes, I'm listening to the fucking song. Just like that. This movie is, in my opinion, is the greatest sports movie ever filmed. And that'll be interesting if we ever do a sports-themed show. But at the same time, this was kind of the precursor for a lot of other films. And like the movie Major League is very similar to this movie. You know, it's just trade hockey for baseball. There's a lot of similarity. Semi-Pro with Will Ferrell, which I think is a great movie, really funny, really underrated, and he's hysterical in that movie. It's almost the same movie, trade hockey for basketball. Slapshot, if you've never seen it, you don't have to even like hockey, and if you do like hockey, you will like this even more, but if you've never seen it, you owe it to yourself to see this movie. Is this a comedy? I'm not really sure, and that's why when I was talking about my favorite comedies, I don't know how this actually plays into that, because I don't know if it really is a comedy. At the same time, I will categorize it as a guy movie. I'll definitely categorize it as a sports movie. You got to see it.
Okay, a couple things. First of all, before I begin my dissertation on this movie, which is one of my top 25 of all time, you are incorrect, Mr. Rose. The woman that he was in bed with was Swoozie Kurtz. Swoozie Kurtz was also she's a character actress that's been in a lot of stuff. The person that you mentioned, which was Lindsay Krause, she was Ned Braden's wife.
That's it. She was.
That's right.
And because he was in bed with Ned Braden's wife. That's correct.
Yeah. So anyway, one of the things about this movie that's so great is if you go into any sort of Facebook page or message group, John McAdams Pro Wrestling or whatever, you know, the CWF group, the 605 Mothership page, all you have to do is drop a quote from this movie. You know, I'm watching I'm listening to the fucking song, or one of the other great, you know, they brought their toys. That just are throughout this movie. I swear to God, I'm going to go out there and drop my pants. I'm going to show them what I got, you know, during the fashion show. There are so many great lines in this movie. If you throw one out there, Big Lebowski is like that. People are going to start firing lines from this movie out there left and right, because this is such a guy's movie. And if you're a hockey fan and you have never, I actually saw something posted on Twitter today before we started the show. They were talking about what is the best hockey movie of all time. And they had Slapshot, Youngblood, the movie Goon with Sean William Scott. And I want to say, what was the other? Oh, it was Miracle. And I actually posted.
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
Why is anyone even talking about another hockey movie other than Slapshot? That is sacrilegious to me. This is not only the best hockey movie of all time. You're right. It may be the best sports movie of all time. And it's not only the best hockey movie of all time. I don't even know if anything else is in the same ballpark as this movie. You know, Paul, go ahead.
What were the other movies? Goon? With that piece of shit?
Yeah,
what were these other movies? Ice Princess?
Youngblood with Rob Lowe.
Oh, God.
Mystery Alaska is a pretty good film, but it's not anywhere near Slapshot. But Slapshot, Reg Dunlop, the way he baits the owner of the team into telling him, you know, he fools the townspeople into thinking they're going to sell the team and they're going to be sold to an owner, an old folks home in St. Petersburg. And what they miss hockey every Saturday night. And, you know, he tricks the people into thinking that they're going to go down there. The list of goons on the other teams, Ogie Oglethorpe, you know, what with the litigation and then the subsequent deportation and, you know, all the guys that are being brought into the other teams, the guys who on the other team, the one guy that's pissed drunk and, you know, he's drunk on the ice and he pees all over himself when he gets checked into the boards. Oh, my God. There's so many classic scenes from this movie. You know, boys, you ready to go in? You know, they cross themselves. Put us in, coach. We're ready to go. And they come up from the Iron League, which is not a league known for fancy skaters, apparently. But yeah, no, this Strother Martin plays the team manager, and oh my God, he's so hilarious in this movie. And telling the story about the guy that was on the team that was a chronic masturbator, would masturbate during the game. But oh yeah, this is not just a great sports movie; it's a hilarious movie. And if you want to sit down and have a bunch of laughs, watch. I'd be watching Slapshot for probably the 50th time.
Yeah.
Just tremendous. So, my number three movie. Okay, as we spoke when we talked about Chuck Norris previously, I'm going to talk about it here and in the movie that's my number two movie. The 80s were a great decade for action films. Action film stars Barry, a previous episode, mentioned Die Hard with Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis, another great movie action star. But one of the guys that really got over big in the late 80s and into the 90s was a guy that was a self-professed Aikido master named Steven Seagal. And Steven Seagal had a real interesting career. Steven Seagal was a guy that, you know, if you listen to the story as told by Steven Seagal, he was a bodyguard for actors. He would train them in different martial arts. And he was offered the role in this movie called Above the Law that came out in 1988, which, by the way, is a really solid action movie. Another movie set in Chicago, same group of guys that are in all those other Chicago movies, was in Above the Law. That had a solid cast. Pam Grier was in that. Along with Steven Seagal, just a solid body of character actors and supporting roles. And I've always found that the best Seagal movies are the movies where he has good supporting roles. When he started getting off later in his career and he was doing the direct-to-video stuff, it was people that you've never heard of. And after that, he did Marked for Death, where he took on the Jamaican posses. He did a movie called Hard to Kill, where he was a guy that had been in a coma for 7 years, Mason Storm. And the movie that I'm going to talk about, though, was, I believe, his fourth or fifth film. It's a movie called Out for Justice. Out for Justice. His supporting characters in the movies were Jerry Orbach, who's a great supporting actor.
Great.
Yeah. And a guy that I've mentioned before named William Forsythe. Oh, by the way, Gina Gershon is also in this movie, who was just a knockout in this movie. William Forsythe in this role, if I thought he was crazy and stone cold, he is so over the top playing a guy whose name is Richie Mandano. And Richie Mandano is a guy who has quite the cocaine problem. And he goes on a killing spree. And Out for Justice, I always love the character names in Seagal movies. Gino Foligno is his name in this movie. And he goes hunting for Richie, because the belief is that Richie has killed Steven Seagal's best friend, a guy who is a cop named Bobby Lupo. And one of the recurring lines in this movie is, "Hey, does anybody know why Richie whacked Bobby Lupo?" That's Seagal's acting. And it's Seagal in Brooklyn. For some reason, Seagal is wearing this like little kind of beret in the movie. And he's just making his way through Brooklyn, trying to find this guy who's on this coke-fueled rage. There's a scene in a bar where he and this Asian guy have a fight with pool cues that they crack and make like kendo sticks. That's amazing. Just watching how fast they're hitting each other with the pool cues that are supposed to be kendo sticks, apparently. But just incredibly over the top, Seagal. his movies, it's interesting. If Seagal put on weight, if you notice, as his movies progress, and Above the Law, tall, thin guy. By the time he gets to Under Siege, he's starting to put on a little pounds, okay? When he gets to, like, Exit Wounds and Under Siege 2, he's full-on fat Steve, okay? And the more weight he puts on, the longer his coat becomes to hide his weight problem. Barry, have you ever seen this movie?
Yeah, I saw it, and I think I saw it about a month ago, and it was on, and William Forsythe absolutely just steals the movie. He is this crazy, over-the-top villain with, as you mentioned, a pretty massive coke issue. And Seagal was such an interesting guy, because when he first started, I think Above the Law was his first film, if I'm correct, and when he first started, he was very unique. We had never really seen a guy like this. He had this really unique way of walking, if you remember, where he would walk with his palms out, Like, he was just so, and maybe that's the Aikido training, if that's legit or not, I don't know. But his movies, he was never a good actor. You did mention Marked for Death, which arguably, or maybe not even arguably, had the worst fake beard of anybody I've ever seen when he's supposed to be in bed for the 7 years or whatever the length of time was.
No, that was
remember
hard
that
to kill.
Beard? It was,
that was hard
it's
to kill.
The worst. Hard to kill. It's the worst. Yeah, because Marked for Death was the one with the Jamaican street gangs.
Yeah.
It's the worst. It's the one with Kelly LeBrock, too, right?
Yes.
And she plays his nurse.
Yeah, and he ends up marrying her, yeah.
Yeah, and it's got the worst fake beard you've ever seen. But he was good, and his style of fighting, we had never seen that before. You know, Chuck Norris wasn't doing that. Bruce Lee didn't do that style of fighting. Arnold wasn't doing it. And I'm trying to think of all the action heroes at that time.
Damn.
What he was doing was totally different.
Yeah, Jean-Claude Van Damme wasn't doing that either.
Yeah, exactly. And that's actually another guy that had his own style. But you know, Seagal was so unique in what he was doing. Never a good actor. He was literally a piece of wood that would just recite some lines. At the same time, the stories that were being built up around him and the stories were actually kind of engaging.
Yeah, the movie you referenced, Hard to Kill, you know, as he became more popular and he got more power behind the scenes, there's a great scene where Kelly LeBrock plays a nurse in the long-term illness ward or the coma ward. And Seagal's character, Mason Storm, is in a coma and he's in bed. So the nurse comes in to look at him. And as Barry said, he's got this horrible beard. She pulls the cover back. And of course, Seagal is there. And I guess she's giving him, you know, the bath or the sponge bath. And she sits there and she goes, you know, one day I really hope you wake up. And then she like looks right down at his crotch and goes, because let's face it, you've got so much to live for. And I'm like, who wrote that line, Seagal? Because
Yes. It
was so cheesy and over the top, you know. Let's let everybody know what I'm packing downstairs, you know. So, all right, Barry, let's get to number two. We got to wrap this up.
Yeah, knowing what we know about him, you're probably 100% right. So number two is a movie, and I know that it is. It's also one of our great listener, Travis Raines. It's one of his favorite guy movies of all time. It is The Terminator. So it's the 1984 classic. It's the movie that really launched Arnold into the stratosphere and made him a star. It's basically about this indestructible humanoid cyborg is sent from the year 2029 to 1984 to assassinate a waitress named Sarah Connor, whose unborn son will lead humanity in a war against the machines, while a soldier from that war is sent to protect her at all odds. And that came directly from IMDb, of course. But this movie, to me, I remember walking into the theater, and you didn't expect much, because at this point, Arnold was, he didn't have a career. He really had never really done much. And James Cameron, who was the director, really hadn't done a whole lot prior to this. And you walk in and you see The Terminator, and it's just this mind-blowing science fiction movie. And it really is iconic, because even to this day, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger's tagline, "I'll be back," started in this movie. You know, he was basically, he was at the police desk and he was looking for Sarah Connor. You know, the sergeant at the desk said, she's not seeing anybody now. She's being questioned. He says, I'll be back. And then he drives the car right through the police station and takes everybody out. So I was blown away. And I remember reading a criticism of this movie when it came out and going, yeah, that's really stupid. And one of the reviewers said something to the effect of, it's a pretty good action movie, but why does the Terminator have an Austrian accent? And I remember thinking, you know what, you schmuck, you're missing the point of the movie, and you're really, you know, missing all of it. But I like it. And even in the opening scenes, you know, one of the early scenes, there's a very young Bill Paxton before he became a star, and he plays one of the three, I guess, street punks, and Arnold winds up beating them up, killing them, and taking their clothes. But this is a great movie, and this also goes to, you know, Linda Hamilton. She was so hot, and, you know, you look at her in Terminator 2, and she'd obviously been lifting weights, and her body sculptured, and good actress, never became this big star, but Michael Biehn is a guy that I thought would have become a huge star. And he obviously is the guy that's been sent down to save Sarah Connor. So I, you know, as I watch this film, and this is one that's on my DVR, I will constantly watch it. I, you know, there's so much about it that I like. There's nothing that I don't like about this film. You know, and Terminator 2 was good. I got to admit, I was lost to Terminator 3, but Terminator 2 was actually pretty good.
I actually like Terminator 2 better than the original. The original, both great movies. It's like, you know, one's a A and the other's A plus. The only problem I have with Terminator is it can come off a little dated with some of the scenes where they're going to the bar to the dance club, and that comes off a little dated. Whereas Terminator 2, to me, it looks like a movie that could have been made, you know, yesterday. It holds up that well. You're absolutely right with Linda Hamilton completely resculpted her body for Terminator 2. And she was very cute, very good looking in Terminator 1. Still attractive, but in a different way in Terminator 2.
Yeah, and so to that point, too, and I think part of it was, and it is a little dated. Look, the first Terminator, absolutely, because they didn't have a huge budget. So they filmed this movie, and then it wound up making, you know, $100 million, whatever the figure was. So they had a ton of movie for the second Terminator, which really took several years. I think it was 8 years later.
Yes.
It was either 7 or 8 years later, right. So there was a real length of time, but a lot of it had to do with the budget. And it does look dated. I think it's less about the disco dancing, which I love, which I just think is so cool because it really does show me the time. But the special effects between one and two are really light years apart. But there's this kind of charm to the first one that you don't necessarily get in the second one because it is a little more low budget. And they kind of shot this thing in Los Angeles. They didn't have a ton of money, which is obvious. And all of a sudden, they had this very engaging story. You had a guy that was really able to hold the audience. And this thing wound up making, you know, 20, 30 times whatever the budget was. So it was an absolutely huge success. And obviously, again, it pushed Arnold into the stratosphere to where he was making just some really awesome movies in the 80s.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's no question. This is absolutely a great epic film. It's funny, think about, you know, we talked before about movies like The Road Warrior and Blade Runner that ended up having wrestling connections later on after they released Terminator. How many tag teams were called the Terminators after that? And, you know,
yep.
But T2, I remember being in the theater when we're watching a movie in Plantation, the movie's a Plantation. And when they were doing the coming attractions, all of a sudden the figure of the robot from Terminator 1 came up and it said T2 coming soon. And I mean, the entire theater just popped. And when that first trailer for the movie came out, again, huge pop, the anticipation for T2 based on the success of Terminator 1 was phenomenal. And great, great movie. You're right. The ones after Terminator 2, not up to snuff as far as I'm concerned, but it's a great story amongst everything else. So, all right, I'm up to my number two. Again, as I've mentioned more than once, not always talking about great movies here, folks, because this movie that's my number two, such a fantastic guy film, but not a movie that is terribly well-received, not a movie that women are going to be a fan of. We talked about guys that had great action movies during the 80s and earlier. Sylvester Stallone. You know, think about the movies he made. You know, of course, iconic characters like Rocky, John Rambo. I tell you a movie that a lot of people don't talk about that's a great Sylvester Stallone movie. It's a movie called Cliffhanger that came out in 1991, I think, had John Lithgow as the villain in it. It involved mountain climbing and stuff like that. Really solid action film if you're looking for one. But if you're looking for trash and guy films, buddy, you can't get much better than 1986 Sylvester Stallone and Brigitte Nielsen in Cobra. And Cobra is a guy who's a cop on the LA Zombie Squad who are looking for a group of serial killers. Here's a wrestling connection. Barry Trivia, do you remember what the group was called in this movie?
They
were the New World Order.
Were they? That's right. That was
the name of the group, yeah. And this movie is so ridiculously over the top, and I've done some reading about this movie, as I talked about in Empire Magazine and other movie magazines. And apparently by this time, Stallone was getting to be a real pain in the ass because his ego was just running unchecked. He had tons of behind-the-scene power. And one of the things that I've read in the IMDb site is apparently – he had gone up to the cinematographer at some point and was complaining about how the movie was running behind time. And I'm going to read you off the IMDb site this quote, which I think is great stuff. At one point during filming, Sylvester Stallone complained to cinematographer Rick Waite that they were falling behind and that he and his crew needed to work harder. Waite responded by saying that maybe if Stallone gets his hand off Brigitte Nielsen, gets his hand off Brigitte Nielsen's ass and stops showing off to the bodyguards, maybe they wouldn't have these problems with time. And Stallone walks away, never said another word, and just went back to work. Kind of put him in his place, kind of a nice thing. A couple other things about this movie. The character's name was Marion Cobretti. Of course. Why would the name be Cobretti? And Marion Cobretti, apparently the character was a tribute to John Wayne, whose name, of course, real name was Marion Morrison, which I thought was kind of cool. There's a couple of great lines in this movie. The tagline for the movie is "Crime's the disease and he's the cure." Stallone in the movie drives a 1950 Mercury, which is so tricked out and so awesome. But there's a great scene where a guy in the New World Order has taken over this shopping center and he's threatened to kill all these hostages not a shopping center, a supermarket. And of course they send in Stallone because he's got the handgun with the special engraving, and it's got an ivory handle and it's got the image of a cobra on it, because of course, you know, on a cop's salary, certainly you could afford that kind of stuff. But he goes in there, and when he finally confronts the killer has a hostage. He's pointing the gun at his head and he goes, "Go ahead, man. I'm going to kill her. I swear to God. And I'm going to screw all these people up." And Stallone says, "It's okay. I don't shop here anyway." And that's the kind of over the top stuff that goes on in this movie. And the killers are so ridiculous. I gotta give a special shout out to the guy that plays I don't want to say the lead heel, but he is a guy named Brian Thompson, who's a character actor who plays the psycho in this movie. He is so scary in this movie that he's another guy you wonder if he was ever able to get work again after this, because he comes off as so nuts. And the guy that Barry was talking about when we were discussing, the Clint Eastwood movie, Dirty Harry, the guy that Barry was mentioning is an actor whose name is, I got to be able to find it here, Barry.
Andrew Robinson.
Andrew Robinson, you're correct. He plays a police lieutenant in this movie. And Andrew Robinson always plays the kind of borderline psycho guy. And he's a cop. And actually, on reading up on this movie, originally the finish of this movie was going to be that Andrew Robinson was the leader of the New World working as a police lieutenant. And they end up scrapping that finish. But it involves a big shootout in a small town in California where they take this witness, Brigitte Nielsen, to hide her. Rennie Santoni plays his partner. Here we go, the Seinfeld reference. Rennie Santoni was, of course, Barry, known as?
Poppy.
Poppy, who didn't wash his hands. Poppy was sloppy, and he got, shut down by the code enforcement. But tons of great character actors in this movie. This is a good, fun, stupid, over-the-top movie. Don't go in thinking you're going to see anything that's highbrow. There's that word again. Because this is not. This is a big, dumb movie, but it's tons of fun. Barry, have you ever seen it?
Have I ever seen it? I saw this film opening night in Los Angeles at a theater on Hollywood Boulevard with my best friend at the time, Scott Bransdorf. So, yes, I have seen this film. And let me tell you, when you see a movie, and I can't speak for now, but back in the 80s, if you saw a movie in Los Angeles on opening night and there was any amount of action, people would just go nuts for it. Didn't have to even be a good movie. Didn't matter. As long as it wasn't boring, people would go nuts, and people went nuts for this movie. So I've seen it. A little bit of a trivia note here. Rennie Santoni and Andrew Robinson, both in Dirty Harry.
Absolutely.
They've actually made our... Yeah, so pretty cool. It's a great movie. Brigitte Nielsen plays a character. Her last name is Knutson, which always makes me think of The Big Lebowski, who the fuck are the Knutsons, which is one of the great lines of the movie.
Brigitte Nielsen is sort of a female Steven Seagal. She's a good-looking piece of wood up on the screen.
Pretty much. There's not a lot going on. And you brought up Brian Thompson. So Brian Thompson, also in The Terminator, he played one of the three punks along with Bill Paxton and the third guy, who I have no idea who he ever was. But they were the three guys in the beginning scene when the Terminator lands in Los Angeles. But he was really good, too, in Alien Nation, if you've ever seen, which is a great movie. And there's this little-known movie that came out in 1988 called Miracle Mile. and it stars Mare Winningham and Anthony Edwards. And it's about, I'm the king of hijack, obviously, but I don't want to totally hijack this. But Anthony Edwards plays this young musician who picks up a ringing phone. It's a phone on the street at a phone booth, and it's somebody telling him that it's the end of the world and a bomb is going to be launched at a certain time. And he's got to find the girl that he loves, who's played by Mare Winningham, and then everything else that happened. And Brian Thompson's got a small role in that film, but he's still great.
Mare Winningham made a career out of playing the unattractive girl. You know, yeah, all those movies. Yeah. But no, great actress, though. Great actress. So, that's good stuff. So, yeah, again, great stupid movie. Cobra, check it out if you get a chance on a rainy Saturday afternoon. Barry, drum roll, give us your number one guy movie of all time.
So, wow, this is tough, but this is the number one guy movie of all time. When I told my wife my top 10 films of all time that we went through a couple of months back, she said, well, why isn't this movie on the list? And I said, well, because we're going to talk about it in a future episode as one of my top guy movies. And she said, oh, because you watch this thing every friggin' night. So just to do a little quote here, you know, I heard you had balls big enough to come in a dump truck, but you don't look like much to me. Well, opinions vary. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Roadhouse. It is the ultimate guy movie. It does not require you to think. It doesn't require you to do anything but stare at the screen and soak up the goodness. That is Patrick Swayze playing Dalton. Terry Funk is in this movie, and it reunites two of my favorite actors, and I shouldn't say reunites. This is actually where they worked together the first time, which is the great Ben Gazzara, who plays Brad Wesley. And then you've got Sam Elliott, and these two obviously went on to work together in The Big Lebowski, which was my third favorite film of all time. So I love this movie from start to finish. You know, the double deuce is the biggest shithole going, and Dalton shows up, and it's nonstop fights. You know, the bad guy, Ben Gazzara, is just unbelievable. You hate him by the end of the movie, even at the beginning of the movie. Terry Funk, obviously, for me, it's just a plus to have Terry Funk. And he's awesome because he's still the Funker. It's almost like they took him from doing his interviews with Gordon Solie and just put him right into the movie. So you knew this was going to come up, Jeff. This was no surprise right here. Even our producer, Brian Last, the great Brian Last, said, so is this going to be a Roadhouse love fest? And I said, well, yeah, slightly, because it is my number one movie. Jeff, I know that you've seen it. I don't know if you revel in living Roadhouse 24/7 like I do, but what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, the first thing I thought of was you forgot the great Kevin Tighe that plays the owner of the Double Deuce. He was, one of the guys on the old TV show Emergency, who actually ended up making a nice little career for himself later on as he got older, usually playing like the owner of a bar or the mob boss or something like that, but a very solid character actor. We had discussed in a recent show when we were talking about underrated TV shows that we thought you should try and reach out and find. The woman that plays the doctor that Patrick Swayze falls in love with, Barry, help her out. Help me out. What's her name?
Kelly Lynch. And you did say that as well.
She is on the show Mr. Mercedes, looking quite a bit different than she looked in this movie where she was a complete knockout. The guy that plays the owner of the auto parts store, his name is Red. What was his name, the actor?
I think his real first name is Red. I don't think – that's actually a shoot.
Yeah. But another guy that's been in hundreds of movies and is always a great character actor. I'll tell you one of the things that bothered me about this movie.
Red West,
yeah. One of the things – I think he recently passed away, I want to say, within the last 6 months. One of the things I didn't like about this movie, and it's a great – if I may respectfully, it's a great piece of trash movie. Okay. It's nothing highbrow. It like I said, it's a Saturday afternoon rainy and you enjoy watching Terry Funk and Swayze in the hair and the blind guy playing the guitar on stage. Was it Jeff Buckley?
Jeff. Oh, he was great.
Yeah. But I could never understand why in Ben Gazzara's gang, he had the fat guy that was like the punching bag for everybody, the goof, and everybody else in the go-home scene is fighting for their lives, and this guy's bumping into stuffed polar bears in the living room and stuff like that. And he was like a comedic foil that just didn't fit in with that particular scene. I thought it was like they tried to play that scene for comedy, and it just didn't fit in with what was going on in the rest of the scene. But no, I mean, Swayze's, you know, pain don't hurt. You know, Swayze's completely over the top. Terry Funk is great in this. Now, I will say, it's funny that you mentioned the Terry Funk connection, because here's what I realized. In my number one, there is also a wrestling connection. So you know what I think we're going to do? We're going to put this up to a vote on Facebook.com/BreakingKayfabe, and we're going to let the readers and the listeners vote to see what is the better guy film of all time, because my number one guy movie with a wrestling connection is Predator. And Predator, of course, stars Jesse Ventura. I ain't got time to bleed. And I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do, Barry. I happened to recently pick up a book. The book is called The 100 Best Films to Rent That You've Never Heard Of. It's a book that came out many years ago. You know, so I picked it up actually at a used bookstore. But I want to read you one of the things that the writer, you get about a page and a half description of the film. And but I think it's pretty much spot on describing the movie. Arnold Schwarzenegger plays the toughest of mercenaries who leads a demographically correct platoon, a big, scary white guy, a big, scary Native American, two medium-sized sinister white guys, and a really big, scary black guy into a Latin American jungle on the flimmest of plot pretexts. The evil U.S. bureaucrat who authorizes the operation is Stallone's Rocky nemesis, Carl Weathers. Weathers, like everyone else in the picture, apparently pumped a lot of iron while hanging on the set with Schwarzenegger. He and the rest of the cast are jacked up like action toys on steroids. Not an arm or neck doesn't bulge like a Christmas sausage. Even their ears have muscles. The camera lingers fetishly over each veiny bicep as it lingers over each inch of glistening, oil-slicked weaponry. All that weightlifting and all those machine guns do the guys little good in the end. They're tracked by an invisible being who tears them to pieces one by one until it's time for the inevitable showdown with Schwarzenegger. That pretty much encapsulates the movie, okay? But there is so much testosterone flowing through this movie. It's just incredible. Every guy, as the author wrote in the book there, they appear to be like Scott Steiner on a good day, completely jacked up out of their mind. And it's just a huge, huge male bonding film as they fight this alien from another planet who's come down to hunt humans for sport. And the makeup on the Predator is tremendous. I believe the guy that played the Predator was a basketball player. I want to say his name was maybe Kevin Hall, something like that. And
Kevin Peter Hall. You're 100% yes. Right.
And he was tremendous in the role. It was an alien. And I've said this before, the whole hairstyle with dreads, you know, not Bob Marley dreads, but, you know, the dreads like, you know, some of the football players wear, started in this movie. This character, the Predator, had dreads. And suddenly after this movie came out, all these people started wearing their hair in dreads. But this is just a tremendously fun action movie. You know, Schwarzenegger, they're accounting for his accent by giving his character the name Dutch. And it's just so much fun as he first gapes upon the Predator. You know, what the fuck are you? You are one ugly motherfucker. And it's just so much fun.
Yeah, it's great too. And when you told me this was going to be on your list, and I actually removed it from mine, but this easily would have made my list. This is a guy, tough guy, buddy movie. And it starts off, I mean, if you remember, they're in the airplane and the guy is shaving, but he's not using any shaving cream, just got a straight razor. The great Sonny Landham is in this movie, who was also in 48 Hours, which you mentioned a little bit earlier. And he just passed away, the great Native American actor. But everything about this movie works, and I was such a fan when this came out. I love the fact, the truth is, it's really, this movie 90% takes place in a jungle. That is their set. It's all taking place in a jungle, and it's all leading up to Stallone, to Schwarzenegger versus the Predator. And you know, and the Predator goes through everybody else until he finally gets to Schwarzenegger. And the epic fight scene between the two of them is just great. I even like Predator 2, and a lot of people don't. And I think the character, the Predator, and you said it, the dreads, everything about him to me was what a monster, and you know, that for lack of a better term, that's what I'm going to call him, is what a monster should be. Even when they made these Alien versus Predator movies, I'm voting for Predator. That's the one that I want to see win. So it's a great choice. It's probably my second favorite Stallone. It's my second favorite Stallone movie, right behind The Terminator.
Schwarzenegger.
Did I say Stallone again?
Yes, you did.
So, yeah.
I will mention that the character actor that you were discussing doing the shaving is a guy named Bill Duke, who's a really, really good character actor, bald-headed black guy. He's been in I know he was in Commando with Schwarzenegger too.
Commando.
So, yeah, Schwarzenegger had, you know, like a lot of these other actors we've talked about, had a group of guys that he you know, he made other movies with Jesse Ventura. And Jesse's great in this movie. Jesse has never before or after been as good as he was in this movie. He really sold the combat veteran in this movie. It's just tremendous fun. I can't imagine anyone who hasn't seen this movie that's a fan of action movies, because it's like the ultimate.
Well, so for our listeners, breaking kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, what is your number one guy movie? And if you're voting between either Roadhouse or Predator, we want to hear about it.
And if you vote with Barry, I no longer want to speak to you. So there we go. So that being said, we're going to wrap things up. This episode went a little bit long. The new Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. First of all, I want to thank our good folks at the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network with Mr. Brian Last for all that he does in helping us with this podcast. We could not do it without you, Brian. We appreciate it. And I'd like to mention again that Breaking Kayfabe is available at Crowbar Press. You can follow me on Twitter at hashtag Bowdrin Jeff. Thanks to Travis Heckel for the new updated artwork for the new Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. Breaking Kayfabe, again, is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And until the next time, we hope you've enjoyed this special edition of Breaking Kayfabe. Folks, we'll see you next time.